Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Some people who feel they need counseling go to psychologist or psychiatrist. Others consult the clergy, ministers, priests, rabbis, imams. Our guest today, Dr. Susan Myers-Shirk, an MTSU history professor, has delved into the history of what is called the pastoral counseling movement. In her 2009 book, Helping the Good Shepherd, which covers the period from 1925 to 1975, Myers-Shirk looks at how 20th century clergy started to combine their appreciation of their respective faiths with wisdom gleaned from a secular, more scientific approach. We'll talk about this blend of theology and therapy after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The Rutherford County Chamber of Commerce has named MTSU's John Hood as the 2013 Business Legend of the Year. The Chamber will honor Hood Friday, February 7th. Hood is Director of the Office of Community Engagement and Support. MTSU's Murphy Center is undergoing significant renovations this semester, including updated concessions and restrooms, a new HVAC system, new arena lighting, and a new roof. Work got underway January 6th and is expected to be completed before the 2014-15 basketball season begins this fall. And MTSU alum Jay Qualls is taking his culinary know-how to reality TV as one of 16 competitors on the cooking contest The Taste, which recently launched its second season on ABC. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com.
Susan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
In the introduction to your book, you write, and it's kind of a long sentence, so bear with me, I argue that the efforts of clinical pastoral educators and pastoral counseling to engage the principles of science should not be interpreted as evidence of secularization or as an indication of the decline of liberal Christianity, but as evidence of their eagerness to find some middle ground between the two worlds they saw as most important and relevant. Did the impetus for this search come from the congregation or within the clergy itself?
That's a really good question. I think there are probably two factors at work. One of them is the historical context of the professionalization of science and medicine in the first half of the 20th century, and ministers generally, clergy, trying to find their place in that world, decided to sort of engage in conversation with those other professionals, those other helping professions. But I think the other, I give them credit for being genuinely sensitive to their parishioners. And this idea that that they had people in need who they didn't know how to help really drove them to look elsewhere. So it's a combination of their own concerns about their place in a larger process of professionalization and how are they going to meet the needs of their parishioners.
This is sort of an old struggle, isn't it? Because we have a lecture series here on science and spirituality, and the two separate ways of viewing humanity are often seen as enemies in mortal combat rather than, you know, concentric circles or just different ways of looking at life.
Right. And certainly the so-called liberal churches have been seen as somehow, I mean, that's they've been framed as having sold out to science, right? And and that goes all the way back, obviously, in the 19th century to debates about textual criticism of the scriptures, and so yes, they have been, those kinds of accusations have been leveled against them, but I do see them as genuinely, again, engaged in an act of faith. But how do you balance? Is there a way for these two worldviews to live together?
The man who is sort of the granddaddy of them all in your book is a man named Anton Boissin.
Boissin.
That's the way it's pronounced.
Right.
And a man who suffered from mental illness.
That's right.
What was his role in the movement?
He had suffered quite a bit, actually had what they think in retrospect were schizophrenic breaks, psychotic breaks. But he had been a very devout and sincere Christian, and he tried a number of other careers, but with his hospitalization for his first psychotic break, he became aware of kind of what the failings of psychiatric institutions at the time. And he became convinced that what patients really needed was some sort of, in a lot of ways, it's equivalent to occupational therapy. And because when he was in the hospital, he realized that there were really no sort of activities for folks who were hospitalized. And so he ends up going back and working in the hospital, in this case in Worcester Hospital in Maine, and then eventually sets up a program where he brings in young seminary students to learn about the environment in the hospital and learn about mental illness. And Boysen's take was that if ministers were educated about the kinds of mental illness that at the time, that they could then go into the parish. He had no intention that they were going to be counselors or hospital workers. His intention was to train them then to go into the seminary, into the parish, and be able to sort of identify people who were in trouble and kind of guide them toward help. But then in the context of the hospital work, to provide these programs that would give these patients something to sort of focus on as they were working their way through their illnesses, because he saw mental illness as something that was ultimately the personality's attempt to kind of reorganize and save itself, because he had been through mental illness and he needed, he was trying to think of it in terms of his own experience.
And it certainly makes a kind of scriptural sense, at least from the Christian perspective, in terms of the golden rule, serving people who need help, helping the vulnerable as Jesus did.
Right. And the other piece of this was that mental illness was sometimes interpreted as a sign of moral degeneracy. And for Boysen, who was a Christian, who had come, you know, had this long tradition of being a very devout Christian, it was very hard for him to perceive of mental illness, obviously, as moral degeneracy. And he began, and essentially what he got involved in was a kind of what he considered the scientific study of religion, where you would carefully document all of these experiences so that you could compare and contrast the religious experience with the experience of mental illness and see how those were connected.
The onset of all of this kind of coincides, not way back when, but with the progressive era as it's on the rise and the philosophy known as the social gospel.
It really does, yes.
Could you explain how these two tie in?
Right. Well, progressivism, of course, is a social and political movement intended to sort of remake American society, and its historians sort of struggle to define it because it's partly about controlling the worst excesses of corporations and controlling the working class and immigrant, but it's also about making a better world, right? So everything from the Pure Food and Drug Act to changes in our political process, so direct election of senators, all those kinds of things fall under progressivism.
After the Gilded Age, we needed a little something other than me-ism.
Right, to rein in the corporate excesses. And so the social gospel then was the idea that salvation was something that was systemic and social, and that Christians had an obligation to the poor in society, to the working class. And so you'll see the establishment of these things like settlement houses, where immigrants and working class folks could come for help and support programs for them. And most famous is Jane Addams Hull House. But yes, definitely then, this idea that society can be remade by the efforts of Christians, and that we are bringing in the kingdom is definitely part of those very earliest the program that Boysen started was called Clinical Pastoral Education. So those first efforts in CPE are very much within the progressive and social gospel framework.
We'll take a break and be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the history of pastoral counseling with Dr. Susan Myers-Shirk, professor of history here at MTSU. What impact did women have on this movement?
That's a very good question. When they first started the clinical pastoral education programs, they did have some women students coming, but they came as in training for, say, to be missionaries. It was not widely accepted that women would then go into the parish as parish ministers. And in fact, there's a lot of, if you sort of trace the history of women in CPE, you'll see there was some resistance to their activity in CPE. But one of the most important founding figures of CPE was a woman named Helen Flanders Dunbar. And Helen Flanders Dunbar was a good friend of Anton Boysen and was a leading theorist in psychosomatic, or a leading expert in psychosomatic theory. And so she brings that element, she brought that element to CPE, and she was very important in organizing the early sort of institutional framework for CPE. The way women figure in later is a little bit different. One of the interesting things about this is that as ministers moved from CPE to pastoral counseling, they tended to focus more on their female parishioners. And a larger percentage of their counselees, and they frequently use transcripts and case studies in their publications, and a larger percentage of those were women. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that pastoral counselors are particularly influenced by their female parishioners' needs as they start to think about what it means to be a good pastoral counselor and what are the core issues in pastoral counseling. They come back to what their women parishioners are asking for.
What is non-directive counseling and how did it enter the picture?
Right. Non-directive therapy or client-centered therapy was really creation, if you will, of Carl Rogers, who is considered one of the sort of founding figures in humanistic psychology. What's interesting about Carl Rogers is he starts out in seminary, at Union Theological Seminary, and then ends up pursuing a degree in psychology. Psychotherapy was sort of up for grabs. It wasn't clear whose professional turf that was. And so psychologists, psychiatric social workers, pastoral counselors, psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, and what Rogers argues for is an approach to therapy called non-directive, in which the counselor listens and lets the counselee talk and essentially assumes that that person has the potential within them to figure the problem out if they're given enough unconditional positive regard and enough support that they will sort of work their way through their problem and work their way toward healing. Now, especially during World War II, when there aren't enough counselors to deal with wartime issues, the door opens for people like pastoral counselors, especially through the USO, to get involved in counseling. And the method that they most often, the theory and method they most often rely upon is Rogers' non-directive therapy, or later he calls it client-centered therapy.
During the war, did the military chaplains pick up on this?
To some extent. That's actually a whole other book. but I think there's a little bit of a divide. Some of the folks who were in CPE ended up as military chaplains, but there's not a direct line between this non-directive therapy and the folks who were working as military chaplains in World War II.
Now, after the war, we have the Cold War, and we have a new scientific age brought on by the dropping of the bomb and a new emphasis on science and technology in order to keep up with, if not surpass, the Soviets. Yet at the same time, people of faith believe we had to do what was necessary to beat the godless communist, quote unquote. So did this help, this combination of science and faith, or this interaction between science and faith, help pastoral counseling progress?
You know, that it takes the story takes a curious turn here, because one of the things that I was surprised to find when I did this research was that there's very little talk about communism in any of their writing. And I really expected it. I expected a kind of Cold War ideology to come along with this. In fact, what they are more concerned about is they don't want a reoccurrence of fascism. They are more worried about Hitler, who is gone,
right,
than the communists. And so a lot of what they're writing about has to do with, and this also links into the non-directive therapy, has to do with creating and encouraging autonomous individuals. The theory here is, or was, that if people were able to be independent and strong individuals and make their own choices, they would be less likely to be led astray by a fascist dictator. The idea was that sort of the explanation for Hitler was that people had been too susceptible to sort of social norms and social shaping, that they had been looking for someone to tell them what to do, essentially. And so Hitler came along and did that, and look at the mess we were in.
Right.
And so pastoral counselors are in the school that thinks, no, what we have to do is create people who are autonomous individuals.
And under fascism, you have the suppression of the free will, which people of faith say God gave to you so that you could make your own choices and your own mistakes.
Right. And so it fits very nicely with Carl Rogers' theories of autonomy. And I actually would argue, and do argue, that much of what we know as humanistic psychology has its roots firmly in the Protestant liberal tradition. There's a little disconnect in some of the literature about that, but I see that as there's a real a solid connection between the way liberal Protestant ministers are thinking about human autonomy and individuality and the humanistic psychology movement that comes out of it.
We'll take another break and we'll return in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about pastoral counseling with Dr. Susan Myers-Shirk, an MTSU history professor who has researched the subject and wrote a 2009 book called Helping the Good Shepherd. The Kinsey Report of the 1950s, mm-hmm. That must have been a heck of a curveball, to say nothing of the sexual revolution of the 60s.
Right.
What impact did those landmark events have on pastoral counseling?
Well, for one thing, it led to a lot of self-reflection and some concerns that that the Kinsey Report would be read as a sort of prescriptive rather than descriptive document.
Right, as opposed to reading it as, you know, we're presenting you with the facts, they were worried that people would read it as a guidebook.
Here, right, exactly. And so it led to this discussion and actually leads them into what I think is some of the most interesting theorizing that comes out of pastoral counseling in the 50s and 60s, in the sense that it foregrounded this question of what is moral and ethical behavior, right? And how do we, what is our responsibility as pastoral counselors in shaping moral and ethical behavior? And, you know, in sort of traditionally, the minister had authority to tell folks, you know, you don't have extramarital sex, you don't divorce, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But here they were practicing a kind of therapy that specifically instructed the pastoral counselor to allow the parishioner to come to his or her own conclusions. And sometimes his or her own conclusions were, I'm going to divorce. Yes. I'm going to leave my husband, or I'm going, and frequently it was, as I said, female parishioners. But the other thing that happened, so what they started to worry about was, is this autonomy run amok? And how do we balance the claims of community, of relationships, of ethics, with the demands of autonomy and individualism? And here I find it's really interesting. They find their answer among their female parishioners, or from their female parishioners. Their women parishioners tended to look at moral problems in terms of who got hurt. So they would measure, you know, what can I do here, and who's going to get hurt? Will it hurt my children? Will it hurt my husband? Will it hurt? And they tended a little bit not to think of themselves as maybe as much as they should have. But what pastoral counselors do is they start to put together this these ideas about autonomy and individuality, and these ideas about our responsibilities to relationships, and they really come up with what I call a gender-balanced ethic, that you must balance the demands of the individual with an individual autonomy with the needs of relationship. And so one of the things I found that was really interesting is they would be talking to their female parishioners who were so worried about everybody else, and they'd say, well, what about you? And they would be sort of nudging their female parishioners toward greater autonomy. And then when they would counsel male parishioners, the nudge would be toward relationships. What's your responsibility toward relationships?
Did the women's movement help nudge women further in the direction the pastoral counselors were trying to nudge them?
That is an interesting question, because one of the things I argue is that pastoral counselors do not then make a connection between their theology and their ethic and their politics. Uh-huh. And you will still find, eventually, women will be going to seminary. And interestingly, a significant number of them are going to go in the field of pastoral care and counseling. But they will still find themselves blocked until very late in the century, blocked at getting, if they want to go be parish ministers. That door is still shut. That's still the boys' club. And so I found that what was really funny is when pastoral counselors do start talking then about women's rights, and they start talking early, much earlier than you might imagine. But when they do it, they talk entirely in terms of, they lose sight of this ethic of relationships that they've come up with, and talk about it entirely in terms of autonomy and rights and civil rights. And it's almost like they don't know how to carry, they didn't know how to carry this very original thinking that they had into the political sphere. It's very difficult, and they didn't quite pull it off. So
we'll take one more quick break and be right back. This is MTSU on the record.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with Dr. Susan Meyer-Shirk, am I right or wrong in seeing the aftermath or the ongoing flow of pastoral counseling in some of the more modern preachers, like Dr. Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking, Reverend Robert Schuller says, believe in the God who believes in you, an attempt to make the congregation feel empowered to have good lives?
I sort of see Peale and Schuller on a kind of parallel track, because in some ways, pastoral counselors tried to distance themselves from Peale and Schuller because they didn't have that scientific and sort of professional training. And one of the places where I see almost more of a connection is in among psychologists and among, I don't want to say New Age, but I think there is some connection there to
people who see health more holistically.
Right, right. And human potential and transpersonal psychology, that whole sort of sense that there is more to human being, there's more to us as human beings than we have really achieved. So any of those, so research in happiness and creativity and achieving that full human potential, I think that's a trajectory really that where pastoral counselors connect. And not politically, it's been one of the criticisms of them is, and of psychology in general in the 20th century, is that it doesn't have enough of a social vision or a political vision. I don't think that's quite fair. I think there are some pastoral counselors who did, but I think part of the issue is for pastoral counselors, the transformation starts with the individual. Mm-hmm. And that's a very Protestant kind of thing.
I don't know personally, and of course this is anecdotal, not scientific or academic, but I don't know a minister today who hasn't either undergone some kind of psychological coursework or has gone back to school in order to pick up on psychological coursework after leaving the seminary. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. And again, and I'm with you. I haven't actually done the research on that, but I agree with you. It seems like, and again, this is also anecdotal, but when I was working on this book, I almost couldn't find a person who wasn't familiar with it, and that surprised me. Mm-hmm. How many people? Oh, my minister counsels, or I. You know, the problem with it, of course, became that to do sort of serious kind of counseling, where someone comes in for an hour at a time, like you would with a psychotherapist, really the weight of that on a minister, with everything else that he or she is expected to do, it is. It's really beyond what can humanly be done in a week. So you started to see actually the emergence of things like pastoral counseling centers, where a single center would, and we have one here in Murfreesboro, a center has a number of ministers associated with it, and they serve all of the Protestant church. I believe they're mostly Protestant, serve the Protestant churches in Murfreesboro. If you want to get counseling that you know will come from a pastoral perspective, you can go to.
Do you know where that is located?
It's right here on Main Street, almost down at the square.
Okay. And if you are interested in the history of religion and psychology, or together or separately, you can check Dr. Meyer Shirk's book, Helping the Good Shepherd, out of the MTSU Library. Helping the Good Shepherd is published by, it was published by the Johns Hopkins University Press in 2009. Check Linebaugh or your local library to see if they have it. Dr. Susan Meyer Shirk, thank you.
Thank you so much.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.